Today's presenter is Robert Barretti. Robert is an advisory software engineer with WebSphere Application Server, Level 2 Support in RTP, North Carolina. He has over 10 years of customer support experience, which includes 7 years of supporting the IBM HTTP Server, SSL, and the WebSphere HTTP plugin component. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Robert Barretti.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's presentation, session number 2. I apologize for those that are having trouble getting in to the conference, but the good news is that this will be replayed on the web, so that is a good point. But anyway, I'd like to go ahead and get started today. Before we move to the next slide, or the beginning slide, I should say, I wanted to mention that a few of the slides, you may see a couple of weird characters. When those slides do arise, I will make a quick note of it. If you're looking at the PDF file, you'll notice that the PDF file, there are no odd characters, but in the webcast, you will notice a slight difference on some slides, and I'll point that out. But anyway, let's go ahead and get started. We'll proceed to slide number 2. Today's agenda, here's what we're going to cover today. We're going to learn how to configure the secure sockets layer within the IBM HTTP server. The main focus is going to be on 6X, 6061. Most of what we cover will be very similar to IHS 2047 and 2042 as well. Specifically, we're going to learn what directives are required to enable SSL website in the web service configuration file. So you will cover the directives you need for that. We'll also specifically learn how to enable multiple SSL virtual hosts. So if you have more than one website that you want to enable for SSL within your web server, we're going to go ahead and cover that as well. Let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 3. Okay, in continuation for today's agenda, we'll also cover how to enable SSL client authentication, which is actually very simple to do, but we will cover it briefly. How to limit encryption at 128-bit or higher for optimal security, and we'll cover it. We'll talk about that more, as we get into the presentation. But there are, by default, the web server does allow for numerous encryption levels, and there's ways to specifically set up the web server to only allow 128-bit or higher ciphers during an SSL handshake, and that's important when you're trying to achieve optimal security. The next thing that we'll cover is how to automatically redirect non-SSL clients to SSL, which definitely is something that a lot of websites administrators as well as programmers desire for security because they want to make sure that all data is encrypted. And they want to make sure that it happens automatically, so there's no need to worry about that. So we will cover that also. Brief overview of the SSL within the WebSphere HTTP plugin. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to cover as much of that as I would like to, but we will cover enough of it to at least give you a good background on how that works and what you need to look out for. Okay, so let's proceed to slide number 4. Okay, first things first. Again, for those that attended yesterday's session, today's session is very similar. I like to put things out in a question-answer type of format because when, being technical folks that we are, a lot of times we're asking ourselves questions when we're looking at issues like what do I need to do to fix this or what directives are required for this, et cetera. So the format that I use is question and answer type. So I just want to point that out. But first things first, what is SSL and how does the handshake work? The secure sockets layer is an encryption protocol used to, one, it's used to encrypt sensitive data between the client and the web and the HTTP server. It also is there to prevent third parties from reading data even if it's intercepted in route, as well as enable clients the ability to authenticate the identity of the web server. And that's key, and that's actually done via the certificate that's passed. The client is able to identify and authenticate the website owner. Okay, and let's proceed to slide number 5. Okay, for data between a client and web server to be secured over SSL, the two parties must first exchange the private and public keys, and that information is actually exchanged via the website certificate that is passed to the actual browser. The method for exchanging the public and private keys is commonly referred to as the handshake. And the next slide number six, we'll go ahead and look at a quick diagram. Okay, so here is a quick overview of what an SSL handshake looks like. Basically, the client issues a secure session request, typical HTTPS URL, and at that point, the web server will actually pass the X509 certificate containing the server's public key, and that public key is contained in the actual certificate that the web server passes. The client then authenticates the certificate against a list of known CAs. Now, all browsers, this is very important because to understand, all browsers by default will contain a list of CA authorities that they trust. They actually have stored root certificates, intermediate certificates, etc. in the browser, Internet Explorer, Netscape, Firefox, etc. And so when a certificate is passed to a client, the client looks at who the issue to is. Basically it compares the issue to, which would be the website name. It compares that name to what you entered in the browser. So if there's a mismatch there, then the browser will actually throw a pop-up and warn you and say, you know, the site that you're requesting, you know, we don't recognize domain name. And it will actually warn the user and throw a pop-up and allow you to select, the client to select yes if they want to continue with the handshake. The other thing that the client looks at is the issued by in the certificate. Who issued this certificate? Was it VeriSign? Was it Entrust? Was it some other CA? It then looks at its list of known CAs that it trusts. If it doesn't find a match, and again, it will throw a pop-up to the client warning them that it doesn't recognize the issuer of the certificate. At that point, the client has the option to not continue through with the handshake, or it can select yes to proceed with the handshake, and at that point, the client will generate the random symmetric key and encrypts it using the server's public key. And once that happens, then you actually have a secure handshake. And so with that, let's go ahead and proceed to slide number seven. And let's go ahead and proceed to slide number seven. Okay, so we just covered a brief overview of SSL, what it's used for, as well as the handshake. And now let's go ahead and get busy with actual configuring the web server. And what we're going to cover here, again, it's in a question type of format. What directives are required to enable an SSL website in the web service configuration file, in this case, httpd.com. How can I enable multiple SSL virtual hosts within the web server's configuration file? How do I enable SSL client authentication? How can I limit encryption at 128-bit or higher for optimal security? And what is needed to automatically redirect non-SSL to clients over SSL? And we're going to go ahead and cover the answers to all of those questions in the next slide. Let's proceed to slide number eight. Okay, so what directives are required to enable an SSL website? It's actually very straightforward. First thing ahead of time, what you want to do is you want to make sure that you create your key file. The key file, we talked about that using the IBM Key Management Utility in session one. You would use the utility to go ahead and create the key file, and then you would go ahead and either generate a certificate request in that key file and send it to a certificate authority, and they would issue you a certificate, which you would then receive in your key file, or you could create a self-signed certificate. But before you even consider enabling SSL within the web server, that is the very first step you want to take care of. You want to go ahead and create your key file, and you want to make sure that you have a certificate that you can use. Once you do that, then the next thing to do is in the actual httpd.com file, you want to make sure that you have a listen directive with the IP address and the port that you want to use for SSL. The example here is just, 123, et cetera, and the port is 443, which is the default port for SSL. One thing I want to point out with the listen directive is the IP address that you choose here should never be the external IP address The external IP address is not known to the web server. Instead, the IP address that you want to listen on is the actual IP address on the physical machine where the web server is running. And that's something that we have seen in the past where there's a little bit of confusion on what IP address to use there. But you do not use the external IP address here. You want the web server to listen on the IP address physically on the web server machine. And the port, in this case, 443. So let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 9. Okay, next, once you created your key file and certificate, you added your listen directive, the next thing you want to do is you want to add or uncomment the SSL module. If it's already in the config file, you just need to uncomment it. If it's not there, then you need to add it. The syntax for doing that is listed here. And again, this is specific for IHS 2.0, 6.0 and above. The module is a little different from IHS 1.3x, but we're not going to talk about that today. Now, the next thing you want to do is actually create a virtual host stanza with the IP address and port you have defined for SSL, along with the following directives. In your virtual host, you want to add a server name directive. The server name defines the website that you want to use for the virtual host. The SSL enable directive is what actually enables this virtual host for SSL. You could have, duplicate. You could actually have a virtual host defined for port 443, but if you do not put an SSL enable directive inside that virtual host, technically that virtual host is not an SSL virtual host, and you could send non-SSL requests to port 443. So it's very important to add that directive. SSL client auth set to none indicates that client authentication is disabled, which usually is the default. We'll talk about more about changing that later on, but at a minimum, you'd want to put SSL client auth none, and it just disables client authentication. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the upcoming slides. Slide number 10, please. Okay, next thing that you want to do, here's an example of the basic virtual host configuration for SSL. It's very simple. As you can see, there's not a lot to enabling SSL in the web server. Probably the hardest thing or the most complicated thing to do is to create your key file and your certificate. But once you have that, it's just a matter of adding the virtual host stanza and uncommenting the load module for SSL and adding a listen directive. And here's an example of a basic SSL virtual host in the configuration file. And basically, that's all you need to have SSL enabled. So there's really not a lot to it for basic SSL. And let's go ahead and proceed to slide number 11. Okay, so finally, you need to add some additional directives which can be placed outside the virtual host stanza. And these are important for obvious reasons. SSL disabled just means that anything outside the virtual host is non-SSL enabled, meaning you don't want to send HTTPS requests to port 80. You don't want to have any possibility of SSL being enabled outside of the specific virtual host that you've enabled. So that's why you would add the SSL disable outside the virtual host. The next thing you want to add is obviously the key file directive, which points to the key file that you created. And that's what that directive is used for. And that goes outside the global scope, or inside the global scope by default, outside the virtual host. And then the next two directives that you'd want to add is SSL v2 timeout and SSL v3 timeout. Those basically are for once an SSL handshake is established with the web server, the client is given a SSL session ID. And the ID contains the cipher information that was used for the handshake, the public and private key information, and it's stored in the daemon, actually stores that in a cache so that if the client comes back and makes duplicate requests, that a complete full handshake doesn't need to take place again. It's basically performance improvement to have a shortened handshake where the client and the web server have already agreed on everything, what ciphers they want to use, what the public and private keys are, and that way they don't have to renegotiate a handshake every time. And the timeout is just how long you want to keep that information in the cache. We'll go ahead and proceed to slide number 12. Okay, so putting it all together, to have SSL, what you'd have is, again, you have your load module, you have your listen statement, you have your virtual host that has the IP address and port, the server name that you're using for the site, SSL enable, which says the virtual host is enabled for SSL, SSL client auth none says that you're not enabling client authentication. SSL disable means that SSL is not enabled outside of the virtual host, so outside of the virtual host would be non-SSL. Your key file points to the key file that you created using the IBM key management utility. SSL V2 timeout and V3 timeout is for the session information. How long do you want to keep it in the session ID cache? Go ahead and proceed to slide number 13. Okay, so how can I enable multiple SSL virtual hosts? Okay, so what we talked about previously is just enabling SSL for one website. Now we're talking about enabling it for additional websites. And the thing that is really key here to remember is that when you're enabling additional websites listening on the same port, example 443, it requires a unique IP address. This is something that we see many PMRs on, where we'll have a configuration file that has multiple SSL virtual hosts all on the same port, all with the same IP address, and then we get calls where the wrong certificate is being presented. Well, actually, it's working as designed based on what SSL is. SSL is an IP-based protocol, and because before you actually have an encrypted session, or before the handshake takes place, everything is done over IP. So as a result of that, the web server hasn't yet looked at the host header to know what the server name is, because obviously that information is not going to come across the connection until the actual connection is secured. So as a result, everything is done over IP. So as a result, if you have multiple virtual host defined, each one must have a unique IP address so that the proper certificate can be defined and can be sent. And that certificate is chosen using the SSL server cert directive. That directive goes inside each virtual host and it specifies the label name of the certificate in the key database file that must be passed to the client browser during an SSL handshake. And again, this is required when you have multiple certificates stored in the same key database file. Or you can use a unique key file inside each SSL virtual host. And we'll go ahead and show that in the next slide. Slide 14. Okay, so here is an example of multiple SSL virtual hosts configured in the web server. As you can see here, you have two listen statements, each one with a unique IP address, two virtual hosts, each defined with the separate IP. Each is a separate site, and you'll notice that each one has its own SSL server cert directive. One is pointing to the robo certificate inside the key file. The other one is pointing to the robo2 certificate inside the key file. So here we have a key.kdb that has two certificates in it, and we're defining in each virtual host which certificate we want to use, which one we want to be passed to the client. Now, as you can see, if each one of these had the same IP address, let's say each one of these both had IP address 89, well, since, again, the SSL handshake, SSL is IP-based, it occurs using everything is done over IP, so if it's all based on IP, then what ends up happening is only the top virtual host gets used, and as a result, the robo certificate will be passed regardless of if you come in to robo.raleigh.ibm.com or robo2.raleigh.ibm.com. And that is something that we see a lot when it comes to PMRs, because there's a misunderstanding that IP-based is required, IP-based virtual hosting is required when you're configuring multiple SSL virtual hosts. So anyway, let's move on to slide number 15. Okay, another example of multiple SSL virtual hosts. Here you'll see the only difference is that I don't have an SSL server cert directive. Instead, I uniquely define a key file, a directive within each virtual host, and each one points to a separate key file. And in this particular case, Key.KDB has one certificate, which is the Robo certificate, and Key2.KDB is a separate key file that has the Robo2 certificate. So if you do have a key file that only has one certificate, then you could technically set it up this way so that the right cert gets presented without you having to specify an SSL server cert directive. Okay, so let's proceed on to slide number 16. Okay, so how do I enable SSL client authentication? In the IBM HTTP server, enabling SSL client authentication can be accomplished using the SSL client auth directive as shown. By default, it's usually set to none. A lot of banks, though, do require client authentication, but not all. Now, what does client authentication do? Some people aren't sure exactly what it's used for. Well, basically, if you have SSL client authentication set to required, what this does is you're telling the client browser that during the handshake that it must pass a certificate, a client certificate, to the web server, and the web server at that point would need to authenticate the identity of the client. By default, only clients are there to identify or to authenticate the identity of the website. That is the normal default behavior when you're dealing with SSL. If you go to a website, a certificate is sent from the server to the client, and the client authenticates the identity of the server. But you can also set it up with SSL client auth required where the client browser has to pass a certificate as well, so that the web server can authenticate the identity of the client. And the only way that can be accomplished is, one is you have to have SSL client auth set to required. You could also set it to optional, which is basically the client has the choice whether or not they want to pass a certificate or not. But in order for them to do that, you would need to provide them a client certificate, and they would need to import that into their browser, and that is the certificate that they would choose to send to the website during the actual handshake. So that's the difference between SSL client auth none, where the client's not required to pass a certificate, and SSL client auth required, where the client is actually required to pass a client certificate during the handshake as well. Okay, so we'll proceed on to slide number 17. How do I limit encryption at 128-bit or higher for optimal security? The encryption level in SSL is determined by the cipher specification used during the secure transaction. By default, the HTTP server has a built-in list of cipher specifications to use for communicating with clients over secure sockets layer. Let's proceed to slide number 18. Okay, the actual cipher specification that's used for a particular client connection is selected from those which are supported by both the HTTP server and client and the client. So what happens is, by default, the web server supports SSL v2 ciphers, we support SSL v3 ciphers, and we support TLS ciphers. And we'll send the entire list of ciphers that we support to the client during the handshake. The client gets to choose what cipher it wants to use out of that list, because it knows that the web server is going to support any one of them. So the client typically will choose the highest cipher that it supports. So if you're dealing with a 128-bit browser, it's going to choose the highest cipher that it knows the web server will support. But what you can do is you can actually force the client to come in on a specific cipher that you choose. And we'll go ahead and proceed to slide number 19. Okay, so the SSL cipher spec directive can be used to limit encryption to 128-bit ciphers or higher. Here is an example of some SSL v3 ciphers, 3A, 3.5, and 3.4. Those are 128-bit and higher ciphers. And what you can do is, by using SSL cipher spec directive, instead of all ciphers, instead of the entire cipher list being sent to the client during the handshake, instead the web server will only send the list containing these three ciphers. And it'll basically tell the client browser, we only support these three ciphers. If the browser supports any one of those three ciphers, it usually will pick the highest one that it supports and come in on that. If the browser doesn't support any one of those three ciphers, then unfortunately the handshake will be rejected and be refused. Slide 20. Okay, so here's an example of SSL cipher spec. You just add these directives inside the SSL virtual host, and basically this tells the client again that here are the three ciphers that this website supports. If the client supports those ciphers, it'll come in on choosing the highest one it supports. If not, the handshake will not complete. Slide number 21. Okay, so in addition to SSL cipher, in addition, you can also use SSL cipher require and SSL cipher ban. Those are two additional directives that can be used to limit access to particular resources based on the cipher which was used. And quick note here, these directives should be used inside a directory or a location stanza only. And you'll see an example here. You do not want to use SSL cipher require or SSL cipher ban inside the virtual host unless they are inside a location stanza or a directory stanza, because the SSL cipher spec directive is basically a broadcast to the client saying, here's a list of ciphers that we support for the handshake. Okay, now once the handshake takes place, then you can say, well, in addition to that, I only want to require certain ciphers for this particular resource. So if a client tries to access a in this case, a resume.html, and it did not come in on one of these three ciphers, then it will be receive a forbidden access for that particular resource. So let's continue on to slide number 22. Okay, so what is needed to automatically redirect non-SSL clients over SSL? It's very, very simple to do. You can use mod rewrite in the httpd.conf, and here's an example of all that's required. There's four lines you can add. You can add these inside the global scope or inside any of your 80, you know, non-SSL 80 virtual hosts. And these directives will actually automatically, any clients who come in on non-SSL will automatically be redirected to the same site name and same URI, but instead of it being HTTP, it'll automatically switch them over to HTTPS, and at which point they'll come in on port 443 and be authenticated via the client certificate and handshake process. Slide number 23. Okay, so last but not least, here is the weird characters I was talking about. If you're looking at the PDF file, you'll actually see what this little diagram was supposed to look like. But anyway, what I want to discuss here is SSL within the WebSphere HTTP plugin. What is required in the WebSphere HTTP plugin configuration file, and what is required in the WebSphere HTTP plugin key file. One thing that I wanted to point out before we go to the next slide is that the handshake, which takes place between the client browser and the web server, okay, is a completely separate SSL handshake than what takes place between the plugin and the WebSphere application server. So if you're trying to, let's say, request WPS/portal over HTTPS and it fails, it's possible that the handshake was successful between the client and the web server, but it's only failing between the plugin and the app server, because the plugin is a client just like a browser. So the plugin performs its own handshake to the actual application server. The application server passes a server certificate to the plugin. The plugin then authenticates the identity of the application server and allows the handshake to go through. So whenever you're dealing with SSL failures, it's important to be able to isolate it. Is this an SSL handshake between the client and the web server, or is this an SSL handshake between the plugin and the application server? And in session 3, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But a quick little thing you can do is if you can get to a static page on the web server over HTTPS, then that is a clear indication that the handshake between the client and the web server is successful. But if you then try to go to WPS/portal and it fails, then that's an indication, okay, the plugin, the handshake between the plugin and the application server is failing. And so when you're trying to figure out, you know, what's wrong with the configuration, you want to look at the plugin to application server configuration as opposed to the client to web server configuration. Okay, so let's proceed on to slide number 24. Okay, so background, the HTTP WebSphere plugin running in the IBM HTTP server acts as a client to WebSphere. The HTTP plugin communicates over SSL to the backend WebSphere application server port, in this case, example, port 9443. Again, since the plugin is a client, the SSL between the plugin and the 9443 WebSphere is a separate SSL handshake, as I indicated in the previous slide. And I apologize for these weird characters, but in the PDF file, you'll see what this was supposed to look like. Slide number 25, please. Okay, so there are two requirements to have the HTTP plugin be able to parse an incoming request received on port 443 and to then be able to establish a connection over SSL to port 9443 of the application server. The first thing you need to make sure that you have is a virtual host defined in your plugin XML for the port that the web server is listening on. In this case, if your web server is listening on port 443, then you want to make sure that you have a hostname colon 443 or asterisk colon 443 defined as inside your virtual host group in the plugin XML. Otherwise, what happens is when the request comes in on port 443 of the web server, the plugin looks at the host header and sees that, okay, the host name is, you know, www.robo.com and the port is 443. It then tries to match that against the virtual host group inside the plugin XML. If it doesn't find a match, it will basically give the request back to the web server, and the web server will then try to serve the request out of its document root, and you'll typically get a 404 back on the browser. So if you want the SSL between the plugin and the app server, the very first thing you want to make sure is that the plugin is going to parse the request and say, yes, I handle this, to send it off to WebSphere. So make sure you have that virtual host defined. Slide number 26. Okay, the second requirement for SSL between the plugin and the application server is you want to make sure that you have an HTTPS transport defined within the WebSphere within the WebSphere plugin cfg.xml, and the HTTPS transport will have one. It'll have the host name of the application server as well as the SSL port that the application server is listening on. It'll also have the plugin-key.kdb defined in the HTTPS transport, and that KDB is used to store the certificate authority signer certificates and also the client certificates if SSL mutual authentication is enabled in WebSphere. Again, similar to a client browser, when a certificate is passed to a client browser, what does the client browser do? It looks at the certificate, who is the issued to, and who is the issued by. It looks at the issued by and says, okay, this certificate was issued by, let's say, VeriSign. It then looks at its list of trusted certificate authorities that it has stored in the browser to see if it trusts the issuer. The plugin does the same thing. Those signer certificates are stored in the plugin-key.kdb, and the plugin will look at the issued by of the certificate being presented by WebSphere, then look in the plugin-key.kdb under the signer certificate section to see if it finds that signer certificate. If it does not find a match, it'll actually fail the handshake, and it will report a bad cert message in the plugin log. If it finds a match, then the plugin says, yes, I can trust this certificate, and I can authenticate the identity of the WebSphere application server successfully, and it will allow the handshake to complete. Slide number 27. Okay, an example of an HTTPS transport in the plugin cfg.xml. Here you'll see that the hostname, robo.raleigh.ibm.com, that is the hostname of my WebSphere application server, and the port 9443, that is the port that the application server is listening on. I define the protocol as HTTPS, so I know that this is my HTTPS protocol, and inside the HTTP transport is the location of the plugin-key.kdb, as well as the plugin-key.sth. The plugin-key.sth is simply a password file that the plugin reads in order to gain access to the plugin-key.kdb in order to look at the signer certificates that are inside that key.kdb file. Again, the signer certificates are there so that when a certificate is presented from WebSphere to the plugin can look at the issued by in the certificate, say, yes, the certificate was issued by VeriSign, etc., then looks in the signer certificate section of the key.kdb, the plugin-key.kdb, and says, do I find that signer in there? If it does, it allows the handshake to go through. If not, it'll actually fail the handshake and record a bad cert message. The reason for that is the plugin didn't trust the certificate presented because it didn't recognize the identity. The big difference between the plugin being a client and a browser being a client, when the browser doesn't recognize the certificate issuer, it throws you a pop-up and allows you to choose whether or not you want to continue. When the plugin doesn't recognize the issuer of a certificate, the plugin doesn't have the ability to prompt you with a pop-up, so it simply fails the handshake. And most handshake failures between the plugin and the app server are a result of the signer not being present in the plugin-key.kdb, so that is the very first thing that you would want to check. The other main cause of a handshake failure between the plugin and the application server is that the certificate being presented is expired. So that is another thing that you want to look at as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in session number 3 tomorrow with debugging. But anyway, let's proceed on to slide number 28. Okay, so what is required? Basically, I talked about this a few minutes ago, but I'm just going to rehash it again. What is required in the WebSphere HTTP plugins key file? As indicated previously, the WebSphere HTTP plugin is a client, therefore similar to a browser. The following must be true. The plugin must be able to authenticate and trust the identity of the server it is connecting to over SSL, in this case WebSphere. The plugin must be able to pass a client certificate to WebSphere if client mutual authentication is enabled in WebSphere. And again, just like a client browser, if you enable client authentication in your web server by using SSL client auth required, you're requiring your client browser to pass a client certificate during the handshake. Where does that client certificate come from? It's a certificate that you send to your client, they import it into the browser. Same is true for the plugin. If WebSphere requires that the plugin, being a client, if it requires that the plugin pass a client certificate, well, where's the plugin going to get the client certificate from? The plugin will pull the client certificate from the personal certificate section of the plugin-key.kdb file. So again, that's something that WebSphere, the administrator or whatever, would create a client certificate and would basically import or add that into the personal certificate section of the plugin-key.kdb. And therefore, during a handshake, if WebSphere notifies the plugin that it requires a client certificate, the plugin simply will look in the plugin-key.kdb, pull the client certificate from the personal certificate section, and send it to WebSphere. And WebSphere will then validate it. Slide number 29. Okay, so this is where the plugin KDB comes in. This key file is where the plugin stores its list of trusted certificate, certificate authority signer certificates used to validate the service certificate passed by the WebSphere during the handshake. The CA signer certificates are stored under the signer certificate section of the key file, as I previously mentioned. This key file also is used to hold the certificate under the personal certificate section that can be passed to the WebSphere as a client certificate if needed. Again, I already indicated that in the previous slide, but here it is again. Slide number 30. Okay, so let's not forget, here's some additional SSL information that we're not going to have time to cover today, but as you know, indicated in the previous session, session 1, there are some additional resources, SSL-related information that I want to make sure, as technical folks, you have this information available to you easily, like what is session ID cache. If you want to learn more about that, here's a link to where you can go and read all about it. Getting started with cryptographic hardware for SSL. If you have a cryptographic device, and you want to learn more about SSL when it comes to that, here's a link to where you can find information on that. If you're using SSL with LDAP within the IBM HTTP server, where you have the IBM HTTP server acting as a client, making a connection to a back-end LDAP server over SSL, you can learn more about that by going to this link. If you want to use SSL certificate revocation list, again, here's a link to where you can find information on that. And basically, a brief summary of that is where you can actually, if a client passes a client certificate to the web server, and you can actually maintain a list where you want to basically deny access to those clients, that's handled via a certificate revocation list that's usually stored within an LDAP server. And you can read about that here. Or if you want to use reverse proxy over SSL, there's information via this link on where you can get that information. So anyway, let's proceed on to slide number 31. Some additional WebSphere product resources similar to yesterday, you know, where you can discover latest trends in WebSphere technology. You can learn more about upcoming webcasts, join global WebSphere user group community, access key product demos and tutorials, as well as view flash replays, step-by-step instructions for using electronic service requests, and then you can sign up for to receive weekly technical My Support emails. And there's some links on where you can find that information. Okay, so that really wraps up today's presentation. I'd like to turn it back over to Elijah at this time.
Thank you, Robert, for a great presentation.
We'll take our first question from Swami Subram with IBM.
Hi, this is Swami. I have one question on this SSL certificate directive. So if I have only one certificate for a website inside the c.kdb file, is this SSL server cert still required?
No, if you only have one certificate in the key.kdb file, there's a checkbox if you view the certificate using the IBM key management utility. You open up the key.kdb, you look at the certificate. There, if you go to view edit, there's an option where you can check it as the default.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you do not use an SSL server cert directive, the web server will always serve whatever you have checked as the default.
Oh. And one more question. With client authentication, wherein the server sends a certificate, expects the client to have a certificate, so which means that is it tied to a desktop or some fixed location? Because once he installs that certificate in his browser, I guess he cannot move it to another desktop or something, or he has to reinstall it on another desktop. Am I right?
Right. Client certificates are specific to the browser, not to a user. So if you have a particular user that's at a workstation and he receives or she receives a certificate into the browser, you know, imports it into the browser, and they then move on to a different workstation and don't take that client certificate with them, the next person who comes up to that workstation could be passing that user's client certificate to the web server.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
No, it's not very clear. Like, can you repeat the point?
Yes, the client certificate authentication is per the browser, not per the user.
Oh, okay. And one more question. This is redirecting non-SSL clients over SSL. Where exactly should we place this directive inside the conf file?
Okay, the load module goes in the global scope. With, you know, it can go anywhere in the global scope.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you would stick the rewrite module, you know, under your, or just uncommented, because it's usually in there by default.
Mm-hmm.
And then the three directives that you see, the rewrite engine on, the rewrite condition, and the rewrite rule, you would actually stick those either in the global scope, meaning it applies to the global website.
Okay.
If you want it also to apply to any non-SSL virtual host, you need to stick it inside those non-SSL virtual hosts.
Okay. And last question. Any additional reading or detailed info on configuring of mutual authentication between the plugin and the app server?
Yes, there actually is. There's a great document. It's called the SSL Guide, and it's actually in the PDF for session number 3.
Mm-hmm.
So if you the PDF's available out there on the web now. If you actually go out there, you could pull it down, and the link is in there. It's called the SSL Guide for Properly Configuring SSL Within the IBM HTTP Server.
Oh.
And we'll actually talk about that. I'll reference that again tomorrow's session, but if you want to get it ahead of time, you can just go to that PDF.
Okay. Yeah, that's all I have. Thanks, Robert.
Okay, yep.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Diana Sue, the Cisco System.
Oh, hi. I have a question on the plugin key.kdb.
Yes.
Is the content of this KDB also a list of a trusted, well-known CA?
Yes. The plugin-key.kdb, when it's created automatically, when you enable SSL within WebSphere, the plugin-key.kdb, the default one that we provide, is automatically created. You can create a separate one if you'd like using the IBM Key Management Utility. But the list of signer certificates that are provided are there. They were provided based on IBM's decision at the time when the product was released of including certain CAs that are well known. And so by default, they put them in the plugin-key.kdb. So if you actually request a certificate from a well-known certificate authority, chances are their signer certificate is already present in the plugin-key.kdb under the signer certificate section. If not, then you would have to actually go to the CA authority's website and actually pull it down and add it in.
Okay. Another question is the handshake between plugin and the app server. You say the plugin is acting like a client. So on the app server side, where is the server certificate?
The server certificate on the WebSphere side would actually reside in the JKS key store that's defined for the HTTPS channel that's defined.
Okay.
Similar to like the web server, the IBM HTTP server keeps its server certificate in the key.kdb, right?
Right.
The WebSphere application server has its server certificate in its JKS key store.
Is this the same as the JDK CA cert file?
No, the JDK, I'm sorry, say that again?
JDK CA cert.
The CA cert is a list of trusted signers.
Okay, so it's a different place.
Right, it's not the server certificate. The WebSphere server certificate that's passed to the plugin
mm-hmm.
would not be there.
Right, okay.
We'll take our next question from Cindy Johnson with AT&T.
Hey, this is Balanand Pini calling from AT&T. Basically, I got linked to Cindy. I had a question. This is regarding IBM documentation you have over the website. On your website, you have said that the ciphers, the decryption, or the order in which ciphers have been used, the higher the decryption rating of 168-bit, it will have an impact on the performance. If it is true, by how much?
How much of a performance difference is there?
Yeah, because the question was asked by my supervisor also that how much impact do you expect if we use the higher order of encryption policy?
To be honest with you, that's a hard one to answer because it depends on, you know, how many requests are coming in.
Suppose you have 170 concurrent requests at any point of time from an SSL or 250 which per server. I'm taking there are several servers. How much do you think there will be any effect?
To be honest, I'm not sure how to answer that.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
Okay.
The next one is you had spoken about the SSL authentication policy to be optional, required, and also none.
Right.
Now, if I use the authentication policy as optional, that means it tells me that the client key store with which a reverse validation which takes place at the SSL is optional. Is it a true statement?
Can you repeat that? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Okay. When I say a client authentication is optional, it means the client is not presenting a certificate to the HTTP server for authentication, right?
Well, optional means that the client has the choice whether or not they want to identify themselves.
Okay. So it is up to the client whether he identifies or not. In that case, now what is happening is that I have only seen like required or none. So by putting optional, are we not allowing other folks also to come in? You know what I mean? I don't see what's the advantage of having optional over none. Identifying and not identifying, you know?
Right. Well, the optional is really used for internal applications where, you know, it's not necessarily required for all users, but for some users you want to require them to actually pass a certificate. I mean, you want them to pass a client certificate, so you're verbally telling them when you come to this website, we want you to pass the client cert that we sent you.
Okay, that's it. The last question I want to ask you, you had spoken about plugin key.kdb, and it has the server authority, client authority, CA certificates, which are default to this, and you also said in the end that if you wanted to add to any of the CA certificates to the WAS plugin key.kdb, you can add. I haven't done this yet till today. I have always made sure the client key store and the server key store are matching, because by majority of the WebSphere Java key stores, when I create a KDB, it matches with the Java key store, but sometimes like Equifax, additional CA authorities which they are needed, I add to the key store of the SSL KDB file. Under, is there any condition when the session passes through the plugin to the plugin k.kdb, it would be required to be added there too, you think? I haven't done yet till today.
Well, I guess if I'm understanding correctly, what you're asking is when you have a signer certificate added on the WebSphere side, is it required to add it on the plugin side?
Is it really required, or is there any conditions under which it would be required?
The only time a signer certificate must exist in the plugin-key.kdb is if the server certificate that WebSphere is presenting to the plugin during the handshake is actually signed by one of those signers.
Yes, we have a certificate. See, why I'm trying to ask this question is I had a problem in communication in the phase one where the KDB file and the client certificates were handshaked. So I had to add Equifax from one of the client where they had an Equifax in the key store into my KDB file. So that handshake got completed. But however, this plugin.kdb, I did not add anything, but still it worked. Am I missing here something, you think?
Well, if it still works, the chances are the Equifax CA signer certificate that you're referring to probably was already in the plugin-key.kdb, because by default, IBM does provide some of the signer trusted authorities already.
Okay, thanks. That's it I have.
Okay.
As a reminder to our audience, if you'd like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. We'll take our next question from Tao Zhang with United Health Group.
Yeah, I have a very simple question. I noticed that in the plugin file, you specify key file as well as the dash file, but in HTTP, we only specify the key file. So I'm wondering, how does HTTP open up this key file?
Okay, that's actually a very good question. The IBM HTTP server, the SSL module, already has built-in logic that when it actually loads the key file directive, it automatically looks for the STH file. So it'll actually look and see if the STH file exists. If it doesn't exist, then SSL is not going to load, and you'll actually get an error in your IHS error log saying invalid password for key file. But you don't need to specifically specify a directive to point to the stash file for the web server, because the web server automatically looks for it. Plugin is a different case. The plugin does not automatically look for the stash file. Instead, you have to specifically tell it where to find it.
Okay, thank you. And I have another question regarding reverse proxy. Is this out of scope?
I'm sorry?
I have a question regarding reverse proxy with SSL. I don't know if this question will be out of scope with this training session.
Well, you can ask the question. I'll do my best to answer.
Okay. I'm trying to do a reverse proxy, and the goal is to go to an internal HTTP site, HTTPS site. However, we had to go through the content switch. Basically, we cannot go to the host directly. We had to for instance, we want to go to an internal secure site, which is company.com, something like that. But this one is defined at content switch OS5. Is that going to be doable when we use reverse proxy with SSL?
I'm not sure I understand the environment well enough to comment on that. I'll tell you what, if you send me an email, my email address is robb@us.ibm.com. If you'd like, you can send me an email with a description, and I'll do my best to respond that way. Would that be fair enough?
Sure. Is R-O-B-B?
Yeah, R-O.
R-O-B-B at U-S.
.ibm.com.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Just a final reminder to our audience at Star 1, if you'd like to ask a question, we'll take our final question in the queue at this time from Syed Akula with Fidelity Investment.
Hey, Rob. The question I have is, normally the HTTP requests are coming from the web server to the app server, right? And we configure the key.kdb and the virtual host and the IHS server. If at all I want to route requests from the app server to the IHS using SSL, is there a mechanism to do that kind of configuration in the IBM IHS?
Well, if you're trying to route, what you're saying is you're trying to have WebSphere open an SSL connection to the IHS server?
No, basically I want to initiate a SSL request out of my app server through the IHS.
Right, to IHS. So in that particular case, WebSphere would technically be a client.
Yes.
Right.
That's correct.
Yes, there's no additional requirement for that on the web server side. The web server would handle it just like any other client. You would need to have Java software on the WebSphere side so that it can act as a Java client. But from a web server perspective, any client can connect to us over SSL. It doesn't matter as long as they're coming in with the right host header, right IP address, and port.
So you're saying, like, if I have an application which has to go out on SSL port, I don't need to do any configuration at the IHS level?
Right. It's all right. Right. As long as IHS is previously enabled for SSL, following the configuration examples in today's session, once the web server is enabled for SSL, whether a client browser is trying to connect or whether WebSphere acting as a client tries to connect, the web server is going to treat the handshake the same in either case.
So if I have a virtual host configuration for a given port, which is actually accepting requests into the app server, I can use the same configuration to basically originate requests from the app server to the outside world? That's what you're saying?
Repeat that last part.
So if I define a virtual host which is basically handling or terminating the SSL at the IHS, right?
Okay, yeah.
Can I use the same configuration for an application deployed within the WebSphere application server to basically send out a request in using SSL?
Yeah, it doesn't, from a web server perspective, it doesn't matter what client's connecting. I'm not sure Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
Yeah. Within the app server, I can configure SSL, right? And then I can bind it to, for example, I'm basically talking with respect to a web service, okay?
Right.
If I configure the certificates at the app server level, I can basically configure that at the server level or the node level or the cell level, and the whenever I try to send out a HTTPS request from for a web service, it uses that configuration, right?
Okay, and you're saying, you're talking about the acting as a client in this case.
Yes, yeah. Instead of using that configuration which is in the app server, can I route that request to the IHS so that IHS can do the SSL on that request behalf?
I'm not sure. I'm still not sure I totally understand what you're asking. I'm really sorry. I'm just not picturing it properly. Again, if you want to send me an email, that way I can get a better understanding of it and try to respond properly. I just don't feel comfortable responding because I don't think I understand exactly what you're trying to do.
Okay. You said it's ROBB.
ROBB at us.ibm.com.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We do have one more question from Carrie Hu with IBM.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question regarding SSL between a plugin and a web secure application server.
Okay.
So, if I have this client certificate, if we have this client mutual authentication enabled, and the plugin has to pass the client certificate to WebSphere, right?
Correct.
Yeah, you mentioned that plugin key.kdb file, we have to have this personal certificate passed to, as a client certificate. So
right.
Where that personal certificate come from? It will create by ourselves, or WebSphere has to pass to that in advance?
Yeah, it would need to be created. You would need to have certificate software to actually create it. You could actually create one using the IBM Key Management Utility. You can create certificates.
In that plugin key.kdb file, I create my own personal certificate inside that file. And
you yes.
And I send over to WebSphere. This is my client from my client perspective, my certificate, and then send it back to WebSphere. It has nothing to do with WebSphere at that moment.
Correct. It doesn't have to, no. You can create a client certificate within the plugin, okay, under the personal certificate section. You just do a new self-sign. You could create a client certificate, give it any common name you want. You could call it Jane Doe, for example. Identify that as your client if you wanted to. And then when the plugin performs a handshake, it's going to send that self-sign cert over to WebSphere. Now, WebSphere is going to look at that and say, well, who the issued to is, it's Jane Doe. Who the issued by is, it's Jane Doe, because it's a self-signed cert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, WebSphere is then going to look in its servertrust.jks key store for that signer certificate. If it doesn't see it, it's going to fail the handshake. So you would actually have to then take that client certificate and add it as a trusted signer on WebSphere.
Okay. I have another question regarding those SSL protocol. When I have a request from my client or from my browser sent to web server through the SSL and then go through plugin to application server through HTTPS, and this is a request going through, when the response coming back is still going through that the same channel with SSL?
Yes, it will go through the same channel, but one thing to keep in mind is if you have client authentication enabled within the web server,
mm-hmm.
right? This is the web server now. When the client browser makes a connection to the web server, it passes the client certificate. That client certificate is not the client certificate that the plugin uses to make a handshake to the app server.
Right.
Okay, I just want to make sure that's clear. Instead, the plugin simply will make the client certificate that the web server received. It'll actually populate one of its private headers called $WSCC header. It'll actually put the client certificate name, common name in there, and pass that to WebSphere. but the actual client certificate used for the handshake between the plugin and the app server is a client certificate that exists inside the plugin-key.kdb under the personal certificate section.
Okay.
And once the connection's made between the plugin and the app, you already have the connection between the client and the web server, and now you have a connection between the plugin and the app. The request comes across, goes to WebSphere. WebSphere provides the response. It comes back across the same connection.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
And we do have a follow-up question from Diana Su with Cisco Systems.
Okay.
I have another question. From browser to the web server, the SSL transition is a handshake is handled by the IBM SSL module. Then between plugin and app server, is it handled by the GSKit libraries?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the global security kit handles the SSL between the plugin and the application server.
All right. Thanks.
And Mr. Robertson, there appears to be no further questions at this time. I'll turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Well, I just appreciate everybody coming and joining, and I apologize again for the problems we had this morning with people trying to join. I know a lot of people got bumped off, so I apologize for that. And I encourage you to attend tomorrow's session, the final session, session 3, and we'll talk a little bit about debugging SSL problems. And that's all I have.
All right. At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. I hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Robert, for presenting today.